Hello, everyone. I'm talking about the role and interest of mobile applications for improving medication compliance. So what's really critical here is the end interest part. So when we're talking about health interventions, we really want to figure out first and foremost whether or not the target population is actually interested in this intervention, whether or not they're going to use the intervention. And that's going to determine the effectiveness of the intervention. So the way that we did this for this research was we interviewed pharmacists and pharmacy users to determine their level of interest in using their mobile phone for helping with medication compliance. So just sort of a side note, when we were trying to figure out how to refer to pharmacy users, we were struggling with coming up with a name. You know, pharmacists refer to them as their pharmacy patients, but I'm not a clinician, and the research team, we're not clinicians, so we didn't want to call them patients. We didn't want to call them customers because that makes it sound like they're just buying gum at the pharmacy. So one of our research assistants wanted to call them informants, but we decided against that. So we're going to say pharmacy users pretty much for most of this talk. So part of this research was funded by the McKesson Corporation. So first I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction and background, and then talk about the methodology and describe the characteristics of the population that we used here, and then discuss overall results and then touch on some highlights. So introduction, I'll start with the objectives. The first objective was to gauge the public's interest in the use of mobile applications for medication compliance and other pharmacy needs. And then the secondary objective was to identify specific features or functionalities that could be used. So to start with a little bit of background on the prevalence of prescriptions amongst adults in the United States, half of all American adults take at least one prescription medication for a chronic condition, and one in six takes three or more. And then patient compliance with chronic medication averages only about 50%, and one-third of all prescriptions is never filled. So this is a huge problem, and we're trying to figure out on a smaller scale whether or not mobile applications are a feasible intervention here. And then this last stat is really quite amazing, actually, that non-compliance to medication results in thousands of deaths each year, 10% of hospital admissions, 23% of nursing home admissions, and $100 billion in direct costs to the healthcare system. So now let's do a little bit of background on mobile applications. So as you can see from this graph, that the customer base for mobile applications is just growing quite rapidly, with 2011 having just about 600 million app customers. And it's expected that by the end of this year, there'll be nearly 25 billion mobile apps downloaded, and that's up from just over 10 billion last year. So it really is sort of like the perfect marriage, as you could see from the slide before, that medication compliance is a huge problem, and apps are just sort of growing, so we're trying to figure out if we can use apps to help with this problem. Sorry. Okay. So the research methodology for this study, we used a convenient sample of 34 pharmacy users and 10 pharmacists in the greater New York area. We conducted semi-structured interviews, and we gave $5 gift certificate to Starbucks as an incentive. All the interviews were thematically coded using in vivo software, and then analyzed to determine if there was a level of interest in mobile features and what features in particular people were looking for. So we, like I said, we had 10 interviews with pharmacists. Seven were from urban pharmacies and three were from suburban pharmacies. It was a combination of phone and on-site interviews. We had 34 interviews with pharmacy users, 20 from that used urban pharmacies, 14 from suburban pharmacies, and these were all in person. So this slide just gives a little bit of background on the population that we interviewed. It was 15 males and 19 females. It was a pretty, actually it wasn't even split between smartphone users and non-smartphone users, and that just sort of happened organically. It wasn't a prerequisite for being part of the interview. 76% of the smartphone users use apps, and the pie chart shows what apps they use on a most regularly, and as you can see, it's sort of like music, navigation, GPS, social networking, and medicine or health is a very teeny sliver. It's the orange one up at the top. And the age profile, the majority of people were between 25 and 64. We also asked people how often they went to the pharmacy and how often they used their mobile phone. So you can see that the majority, 41%, went to the pharmacy once a month for prescriptions. And down at the bottom graph, most people were using their phone anywhere between 1 to 3 hours a day. And that's not just for calling, it's sort of any phone use. So our sample is actually ahead of the national adoption of using applications. So if you look at the circles, it starts with all adults in the United States. 82% of those adults have a cell phone, 35% have apps, and 24% use apps on a regular basis. From our small sample, 38% of our respondents used apps, so we had a little bit higher than the national average. So I'm going to move into the results next and start with an overview. So first, we had a pretty low response rate from pharmacists, only 33%. And the reasons that they were is that the pharmacists were too busy or they weren't interested in mobile, so they didn't want to participate in the research, or they just didn't answer their phone. For pharmacy users, we had a 54% increase, or 54% response rate. We tried to talk to 63 customers that were approached, and our percentage went up after we started the incentive. So we started all of the interviews by asking what the biggest inconvenience was for the pharmacy. So this is for users and for the pharmacist. And the reasoning here is once we figure out sort of what the big inconvenience is or what the big problem is, then we'll try to use mobile applications to solve this problem. So for the pharmacy users, it was far and away wait time. And that's can be manifested in a couple different ways. It's between drop-off and pick-up. It's also for if you get to the pharmacy counter and it's not ready, you're just waiting. Medication not being in stock. Actually remembering to pick up your medication is a big inconvenience for some people. Unable to afford medication. And restrictions by the insurance plan. So you can sort of see that all of these inconveniences could explain poor medication compliance. Okay, so for the pharmacist, their biggest inconvenience, most of them were surrounding insurance issues. So whether it's issues with deductibles or co-pays or getting prior approval before filling a prescription. Another big problem was realizations by the patient at the counter. Requirements for mail order prescriptions is burdensome for some insurance companies. Lost scripts, medication being out of stock. And one of the biggest points that pharmacists were making is that they are always the bad guy, and it's not most of the time it's not their fault. But they're the face at the right behind the counter, and maybe it's the physician didn't send the script, or maybe the insurance company won't cover it. But people get mad at the pharmacist because they're the one who's right there. So there was several themes that were coded out of all of these interviews, and some of them. Cross in between users and pharmacists, and I'm going to sort of pick out some of the highlights of the more interesting ones to share with you. So this was really interesting. It was the perception that the pharmacist had of their patients, and as you can see from all these quotes, the pharmacist just did not think that their pharmacy patients would be up for using mobile applications. They cater to a sort of over 65 crowd. Those are the people who are taking chronic medication. Those are the people who are taking multiple pills a day. And they came off as very protective of this population and didn't think that mobile was the solution. And this quote sort of sums it all up quite nicely, that a younger crowd would eat something like this up, less human interaction, saving time, being more efficient, that it's just not the lives of older adults, and they are the ones on most of the medication. Another theme that came out of all the interviews was know before you go, and that was a big one for pharmacy users. They want to know how much a prescription is going to cost before they get to the counter. They want to know exactly when it's going to be ready, and you know, this could help with medication compliance, but there is the flip side that this might lead to not actually going through with the prescription. So if you know before that it's going to be $100, maybe you just won't even submit the prescription. So there's pros and cons. The pros are reducing sticker shock at the counter, reducing wait time, and reducing abandonment. So you put the prescription through, but you never come and pick it up. The cons of knowing too much before you go is that, you know, in-person interaction at the pharmacist counter is very beneficial, especially if it's complicated medication or complicated regimen. And then also, as I mentioned, point of sale provides a little bit of pressure for actually purchasing the medication. So if you don't know that it's going to be $100, and if you knew before, maybe you wouldn't do it. But you get to the counter, the pharmacist is looking at you in the eye, you're going to pay for it. So there's two sides to this. Another interesting sort of theme that came up was using the pharmacist as a live resource. And this, we asked both the pharmacist and the pharmacy users, and it was very interesting the how pharmacists answered and how the users answered. So for pharmacists, they did not want to have to be asked questions or have to message back and forth with the pharmacy user. And they thought that their customers would really want this. They thought it would sort of like be a big hit, but they didn't want to offer it because they don't have the bandwidth to go back and forth, the lack of clarity. So it's very important that people are understanding each other when you're talking about dosage or proper ways to take your medication. So this could lead to miscommunication, the timeliness of an answer. So is it an emergency? Do you have to text right back, you know, in the next 5 minutes, or can you answer 2 days later? So what would be the expectation there? And then also, how is the pharmacist going to get reimbursed for such messaging? If it's consultative in nature, you know, is the insurer going to pay for this? Is it going to come out of the pocket of the customer or the patient? So when we asked the same question to the pharmacy users, they actually were not that interested in this. So it was kind of funny that the pharmacist was so against it but thought it would be a high priority of users, but it really wasn't. Most respondents said that they wouldn't use it on a regular basis. That was sort of an unnecessary feature, and most people actually would want to go directly to their physician for any clarification, and that's including specific medication questions. They would actually want to go to the physician instead of the pharmacist. So what about compliance? We asked sort of open-ended questions about how would you want your mobile phone to help you with medication compliance. And far and away, the most requested function was refill reminders. So 74% of people mentioned this and said that they would want it. It was pretty diverse in how people wanted to be messaged, whether it could be text message, email, or integrated into a calendar. Again, the reminder days was pretty, had a wide range between 2 and 7 days for refill reminder, depending on the individual. And then down at the lower half of the slide, these are other features that every single person that was interviewed wanted. They wanted automatic refills, so you don't want to have to call in to get a refill again. They want it just to be automatic. They want prescription renewal messages, so if you're you know, if your prescription is going to be out, your 6 month prescription is going to be out, you want a message, you know, a month in advance so you can talk to your healthcare provider. And then courtesy messages. If your prescription is going to be late or it's out of stock, they would want courtesy messages. Okay. So what about medication reminders? So this sort of goes back to in the beginning when I talked about how a lot of people aren't taking their medications properly. And is this because they just forget, or you know, they don't take it with like in the morning with food as they're supposed to? So a medication reminder you would think would be sort of like a great tool for this, but people actually did not really want this at all. Only 36% wanted actual medication reminders. And the reason why people said no was that they kind of thought it was overdoing it. It was actually really interesting to hear the language that people would use. They sort of almost got offended that they would need their cell phone to remind them to take their message. Like one woman was sort of saying, like, I'm not that old yet. Like, I don't want to have to rely on my cell phone for this, which is a very big disconnect between, you know, 50% of the people aren't taking their medication properly, but they don't want to be reminded. Another big issue that came up was responsibility for data. And this sort of goes back to people want to put in the least amount of effort possible. They want everything to be auto-populated. And this is sort of a big concern if you're going to be having a calendar remind you when to take your medication. Is it going to be really specific instructions? Who's going to write that out? Or is it just going to get like auto-populated into your phone? So it was sort of a hot button issue because nobody wants to be responsible for the data. And then another concern is, you know, most people don't use the same pharmacy every single time they go to the pharmacy. So is there going to be some sort of network for sharing this information? And then another concern is security. So, mobile phone, it moves around with you. You can leave it quite easily. So if you have all of this prescription or medication history on it, are you going to be concerned that somebody could hack into it, you know, it's online, or just pick it up? So the majority of people were either concerned and very concerned. And it's kind of interesting, the people that were very concerned are the people that don't have smartphones. They are the people that also don't use online banking. So it sort of goes hand in hand that if you're a little more, you use technology on a more regular basis, you wouldn't be quite as concerned with having health information on your cell phone. And then text messages. So this was the most preferred way to get in touch with somebody, was text messages. This was when we talked about notifications or reminders. People wanted to get a text message. They didn't want to get an email. They didn't want to get a message through an application. And this was also the answer for people who don't have smartphones. So it works if you just have a regular cell phone. And one of the interesting things that actually a lot of people said is that they wanted the message to say from, like, whatever pharmacy you use. They don't want it to just be a strange number. So these are questions to consider and next steps. So we sort of understand that there's this great potential for cell phones and applications to impact medication compliance, but we really need to consider the user, who would most likely be an older adult who takes multiple medications. If we remember back to the quotes that the pharmacists were saying, like, should we actually wait 10 years? Should we wait until people who are taking medication are the people who grew up with computers or cell phones? Or should we try to bridge this digital age gap? You know, what sort of interventions could we use there first? So then a mobile application, you know, would be easy for somebody to use. And then finally, next steps that we're actually doing it in the lab is to actually test the clinical and cost effectiveness of using these applications. So we're going to, we're working with some pharmacies in Washington Heights neighborhood in New York City that are going to be sending out text messages. So it's not going to be mobile applications, it's going to be just a regular cell phone, to look at whether there are clinical outcomes to getting reminded to take your medication. That's it. So this is my email and the number for the lab if you have any questions or are further interested.
So it's now time for discussion, question and answer, comments. Please.
To our lady from Hawaii, you had 4 FQHCs in your study. Mm-hmm. Listed, one is being heard in the island of Oahu. Did you break out the data to see if emergency room decrease was related to the rural FQHCs more or less than the urban FQHC?
So for the study, we actually have a control intervention group So what I shared was just an intervention group, because there actually are, in the control group, is actually mainly rural health centers. So one of the things we're actually doing right now, just looking at just the control group and then for both, is looking at the issue of access to the nearest hospital from THC. So at least for the four THCs that were presented in my presentation this afternoon, we didn't see anything that could show that being in an urban area would be to increase emergency rooms. Because actually for all those THC, the three THCs that were in rural areas, it was actually a hospital pretty nearby. So.
Well, it actually, I think, is the reverse. Empirically, as a clinician and working in the inner city, I see this all the time. I don't have access, my patients don't have access for a same-day need in my clinic. In an urban setting, there's a lot of other opportunities besides the ER, right? An urgent care, for example, or a ready clinic or something like this, rather than the complete emergency room. In a rural area, those mid-level access points might not be available. I'm just wondering, especially in Hawaii, you know, maybe the only other alternative is the emergency room, if your doctor's not available for what you perceive as a same-day issue.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. That's not something we've actually considered. Yeah, I just do know that, because actually one of the reasons why we decided to target diabetic patients was because, in general, at our partner CHC, it's the diabetic patients who are Native Hawaiian who are the frequent flyers to the emergency room.
Well, that's not a common population.
So when I finish my data analysis, I really need to control for a lot of these different geographic factors.
Yeah, I think that might be an important aspect. Yeah.
I still have a lot more to do. So, thanks.
Can you just expand a little bit on some of the pay for performance process changes or some of the things that were done between your baseline case and what the improvements were done?
Right. So as I had mentioned during my presentation, so there were three different bonus rounds. So basically what happened was each of the THC's intervention group, we left it up to them on how they wanted to actually distribute their incentives. So for instance, one of the THC's, they decided they actually wanted to incentivize the patients themselves. And then the other three decided to incentivize the provider teams. And even the method of, I guess, receiving the incentives themselves also really differed from actual payment in a check, or for some of the staff, which is a pizza party and a $50 gift certificate to a grocery store or something. So that's actually one of the other things I'm hoping to analyze as well. And then so basically, the Medicaid payer, they allotted a certain amount of funds to each of the CHCs, and then each of the CHCs, they had their own unique plan on how they wanted to distribute the funds. In between the intervention periods, so after they received a report from me saying, oh, you're able to distribute the incentive because your rate went down a certain percentage. And then they would also at that time be able to log into the reporting system and see kind of a breakdown, like who are the actual patients, what are their names, who's this one patient who's been to the emergency room 13 times in the past 6 months. And actually, I think when I was looking at the data, there was a patient who had, I think, 30-something ER visits in 6 months. Yeah. So, so as a statistician, you know, we kind of see them as an outlier, but then for them, you know, like, they don't want someone going to the ER 30-something times. So they actually proposed to us, you know, give us we need to know the patient name, like, who is this person, so that we can really target them and provide them with better care.
Yeah. To add to that, in terms of, did they share any of the clinical changes that they did differently to promote the lack of, having it come back to the ER?
Yeah, so one of the unique aspects of this project was that it's really a team-based approach, so it's not just the primary care physicians. So again, it really varied by each of the CHCs. So for instance, they decided, okay, we need to target John Doe because he visited the ER 30-something times in the past 6 months. And do depending on the CHC, if they work with health educators or any other providers who do diabetes care, they would pick up some kind of strategy to target that specific individual as well as other patients with similar characteristics.
Thank you.
Yeah, so there's actually like a lot of different levels of the analysis, looking at the control and intervention group at a very aggregate level, with the just a regression, but then it's also analyzing the different strategies and best practices at each of the CHCs to see what worked.
Yeah. Can we go to this? She had her hand up for a while. She's been patient. Okay, this gentleman and this gentleman.
Yeah, again, a lady from Hawaii. What was the psychosocial comorbidity that, or morbidities that you targeted? You had diabetes or CAD and?
So 100% of the patients have psychosocial. So there's actually a whole long list of all these different ICD-9 codes. So it's basically any of the, there's a lot, I think like a couple hundred.
I'm just curious. I mean, could it be as severe as, say, paranoid schizophrenia versus just mild anxiety?
Yeah, so it included all of that. So actually, as I had mentioned, I'll be conducting analysis looking at the comorbidities.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually having that broken down by, mild depression versus, schizophrenia or dementia.
Okay.
Yeah.
You had mentioned about power of this data going to a registry for use, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how you see this data, where it would be residing, how it would be used, and who actually would end up owning it.
Right. All very good questions. So this was funded by ARA. This was a grant. The arrangement we have with this grant is it's a cooperative agreement that we have with them, so we're in close partnership with them. The data is will belong to the to the participants in terms of a registry. It will be housed centrally. However, I said each of the nodes will also have their data, so you can think of it as the centralized data coordinating center. Then you have the research nodes with the clinical centers. So the clinical sites will send the data to the research node center. So the clinical sites affiliates, which form the research nodes, will send the data to the research node center. They will look at the data, they'll clean the data up, and then they will send the data to the centralized data. So the data, the national data, will be located centrally. However, the research node centers will have their data for all the clinics within the research node. Yeah?
Dr. Felix, I'm with ARC.
Oh,
I'm interested in some of the
What I didn't say, we have been working with ARC, and we could always work more closely with ARC. So the money that those were funded, if you remember, ARA was $1.1 billion, $400 went to NIH, $300 went to ARC, $400 went to the department. The $10 million went to the department, but ARC managed the department's $400 million. So the money we got it was the department to ARC to HRSA. So we worked with Kathy, Kathy, who was the deputy, I'm blanking on her last name. Kathy Kendricks. We worked with her, and we've been in conversations with David Myers and with Francis Chesley, and working with them and letting them know about what's yeah.
Just a couple of particular things.
Sure.
ARC has already done a study on comparative effectiveness of the diabetes medication.
Uh huh.
Now I don't know; it may not be adequate because you might feel like it doesn't address the underserved.
Underserved populations. Yeah.
So it might be worth doing it again. And mm-hmm. it was a meta-analysis of other studies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they have a stakeholder group, and the whole process has got some money through ARA to come up with an even better process for engaging stakeholders and input into the kinds of research
that's
we
cool.
should be doing. And so you might want to
yeah.
build off of
yeah, like
some
that.
Of that work to get your patients.
Community engagement to get more full
yeah,
community
yeah.
and stakeholders.
Right, yeah.
So who would I? Who would?
Community virtual vetting.
Yeah. Who would I? Is that out of the EPC program?
I'm sorry.
Is that out of the EPC, the evidence-based practice?
No. It's more broadly in our Center for Outcomes and Evidence.
Okay.
Joanna, and I'm blanking on her last name. She's the person who.
Okay.
Would
you?
Program, but I'll give you my
email. Okay. Great. I want to follow up on that.
I
will. Okay. Great. That's helpful. Thank you. Any more questions? Mm-hmm. Yes, this.
For the mobile app, did any of the pharmacists, I know they said that their patients were older and so not really using apps, but did you feel like any of them were hip with it and wanted to use apps?
The pharmacists?
Yeah,
there was a couple. That was sort of like a general statement by most of the pharmacists that they thought that either people who really need to be reminded to take their medication or the people don't have a smartphone. There was a couple, like one or two of the pharmacists were younger and sort of really liked using technology, and they were the ones who wanted to try to think of a way to bridge this gap so that it could be used. So it wasn't sort of like a law that we don't want to use this for our patients, but there's a couple of like, hurdles in order to get this going.
Yeah,
I was going to
ask how old
the age range of
pharmacists.
We actually didn't ask them for their age. I mean, just from looking at them, I was from an early age pharmacist, older.
I think it's interesting that the pharmacists thought that the people that needed to know about, needed reminders were too old, were older, and wouldn't use a smartphone. Then the older people that you interviewed were offended by that and said, I don't need a reminder to take my medicine. So, I mean, then there's probably some other other causes for the reason why they're not taking their medicine, and maybe too expensive, so they're stretching it out. If somebody doesn't remember to take it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different reasons why people aren't taking their medication. We're sort of speculating as to what some of them can be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it definitely can be all of them, or and most of the time, probably a combination of a bunch of good things, which is why it's so hard to intervene or to come up with a good solution.
Did that come out in the conversation? Did they give you reasons why they weren't taking
it? Most people, it wasn't that they couldn't afford it for most people. Most people, since we did target people that were actually taking out medication at the time or using the pharmacy at the time, which most of them had insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people don't actually realize that they're not complying 100% also. So you sort of like say, are you having trouble remembering or are you complying?
this is it? Any lingering questions? All right, I want to thank you, the audience, you, for your participation. I also want to thank the speakers. Thank you very much.